Hello and welcome to the latest episode of the Pedagogy Matters podcast. The purpose of this podcast is to bring to the fore some key topics of conversation in relation to learning and teaching, to discuss and break down aspects of practice and provide snippets, advice and guidance as to how to integrate these into our daily practice. Today I'm delighted to be joined by Boyd Stewart, lecturer at Edinburgh College, and we'll be discussing really Boyd's teaching practice and how the last few years have helped to shape his practice. So Boyd, good morning, how are you?
Good morning. I'm fine, thank you very much. Pleased to be here.
Great. I'm delighted you could join us, Boyd. And I think it's probably useful to start off with, if you don't mind, just sharing a little bit about kind of what your role is, what your background is, and kind of what you do at Edinburgh College.
Okay. I've been teaching for 25 years. I teach specialist subject patisserie and confectionery at Edinburgh College, which is a HNC level course. Over the years, I've taught various amounts of different courses, from learning support all the way up to HNC professional cookery.
Not fantastic. So 25 years, I bet there's lots that you've seen over that period of time, lots of changes, lots of things that have worked, lots of things that have come around in a circle again. So yes, I think I'm going to start with a really broad question. So how do you think your teaching practice has evolved over your career?
Well, like I say, it's been a long career. I've delivered a range of courses, and I've taught in numerous different amounts of courses through different awarding bodies. And I think that's one thing that's kind of gone in a cycle. You know, when I first started, we had a particular awarding body. We've gone on to other awarding bodies, and we found ourselves back at the original awarding bodies again. I think that both me and the learners and the colleagues have just seen a vast change in the way that the delivery model has come about. I think more recently, with COVID and with now this year with the economic situation, we're having to think even more about our delivery.
No, and there's some really interesting points there. And let's dig into that a little bit. So you kind of touched upon COVID. You stole my thunder a little bit. So in terms of, so COVID obviously threw everything up in the air and changed everything that we know and deliver. So let's start with COVID. How was that for you? How did that change your delivery models and delivery practice?
Well, COVID for us was, and I'm sure a lot of my or your listeners all empathise with this, is that we thought it was going to be a couple of weeks. And for me personally, I remember the day I was teaching a practical class, and I was told that when you finish up, you will not be returning to the classroom. And it was as blunt as that. Now, fortunately for us, it was in March, so we're coming towards the end of our course, so the learners in that particular course weren't mega affected. However, we still hadn't completed all our assessments. And it was quite a shock. So we went from teaching practical subjects to not teaching practical subjects, which meant we had to then try and cross over learning and assessment successes and try to put them towards other parts of the course that perhaps we could cross over results. And to finish off all our sort of underpinning knowledge parts of it, we literally had to learn how to teach online. And for us, that was massive, because we didn't have the technology, we didn't have the understanding of Teams. I think, like a lot of people, we didn't start with Teams, we started with Google.
Right, okay, Google Classroom, yeah.
Google Classroom, and it was horrendous. It was really, really horrendous. We got through it, but luckily our students went along with us, and we got there in the end. But then it meant we had to develop a whole range of teaching material for the following year, because it became clear that we were not going to be back on campus anytime soon.
Yeah. No, and I think that's really interesting. Yeah, there was that initial shock, and then there was realization, wow, this is more than 2 weeks. The positives of saving and petrol are then far outweighed by, crikey, how am I going to engage with all these learners in this medium then for a significant period of time? And you absolutely touched upon that. Next bit there is, right, well, the next academic session, we're starting afresh online. So how did that go?
We our course is built as two parts. My course is a very practical course, so it's teaching practical skills, and I want to talk about that a little bit later on, and how I've developed the change in my approach to teaching. But the other part is underpinning knowledge. Now, the underpinning knowledge generally was teach something and then test it.
Yeah.
And teaching something online where 85% of your learners weren't face to face, they might have the microphone on, but they certainly weren't prepared to have the camera on. And often we joked, and I'm sure other teachers have been the same, is because they were probably in their bed in their pajamas while they were listening to us. But it was really, really, really difficult to actually engage with the students. And when in my particular subject, when I teach underpinning knowledge, it's generally done in the kitchen. So it's done in a side or in conversations or micro demonstrations, or, you know, a student asks a question and I'll maybe just develop the question and speak to the whole group rather than just that student. So a lot of their learning was done in the kitchen, and it was naturally occurring.
Yeah.
Whereas I had to then go and write a plan, write a lesson to pass on that knowledge for them to learn, to be tested, because they weren't doing the same amount of practical. I mean, we were quite lucky that we had this dispensation. We could bring, as soon as we were allowed to bring students back into the kitchen, then we did. However, we still had to practice the 2 meter rule. So instead of having 14 students in a kitchen, I had 6, which meant I had 3 groups of students per week. So instead of teaching them 18 hours a week, I was teaching them 6 hours a week.
Yeah.
And then the rest of the time was what we call it blended learning. But, you know, I was trying to give them activities to do outside the actual practical classroom. And again, that was challenging. The end result for us was that we only gave them their award based on the minimum that was required by SQA, which was 12 units, whereas we actually deliver 18 units on our course, which makes it a full-time course. So by delivering the 12 units, but what I was forced to do, I was forced to take away 2 of probably the key units that the students really wanted, which for my course was advanced chocolate skills and advanced sugar and pastillage skills, because they were quite intensive and I just didn't have time to develop them. So the year finished with those group of students getting just the minimum credits that was required for the award, which was a shame. It really was, you know.
Yeah, and I know it's a real difficulty, you know. I think it was more of a needs must kind of type of delivery we had to go to. But I'm kind of really interested, you've kind of alluded to 1 or 2 of these bits already, you know, and as always, as kind of professional practitioners, we're always reflecting. And I know you kind of touched upon in terms of moving forward. So what I'm keen to know is, kind of based upon your learning from the 25 years, as well as with COVID, kind of what principles do you now put at the forefront of your teaching practice?
I think I recently did a course on critical and creative teaching. And I kind of was heading this way myself, is because I think over the years that I've taught, when we've had sort of low engagement or high dropout rate, or, you know, where we've not had the successes we want, we've tended to blame the student for that and not look at ourselves and not reflect on perhaps it was our course content or the way we delivered the course or even just personalities. We kind of thought that we were better than that, it wasn't our fault if a student didn't engage with us. And I thought that probably ring a bell with a few people. And I'm not suggesting that that's the approach that everybody takes. I think that people take a different approach. But when I was doing this course, I did quite a lot of research, and I came across a paper written in 1957. So, you know, it wasn't a new thought, and it was actually a lecturer in Australia talking about teaching carpentry skills, and what he concluded in this paper was that we can't teach fine developed skills in 36 weeks in college. It's just impossible. And that the emphasis needs to be on the employer and the apprenticeships to actually develop these skills. And what we should really be looking at is we should be more looking at meta skills and capabilities and getting students ready for work. But really what we're saying is that most school children and college leavers leave their education, and about 50% or 58% of them aren't ready for work because they haven't developed these skills. So I think over the last few years, that's where I focused, is look at capabilities, you know, look at things like communication, problem solving, resilience, you know, and leadership skills, all these sort of things, and trying to build them into my lessons. And consciously, when I do a lesson plan now, I look at these things and say, these are the things I want to help teach my students, as well as just the practical skills, because not all of them can reach the level that you know, you've always got your four or five students who are always better at the sort of practical skills and just have that natural ability that you can develop. The rest of them, they can develop the skills, but they're never gonna win any prizes. They're never gonna win any competitions, but they're still competent at what they do. And I think it's important that, you know, when you have students across the range of abilities, that you give them the same opportunities in terms of working on their meta skills and working on their capabilities, and do it consciously and feedback on it as well, not just to sort of do it silently.
No, I would totally agree with that. And yeah, I'm a big believer in, actually, we'll take a step back. Often, as a new lecturer, you're getting a routine of delivering a course in the way that, in a cyclical way, so it might be unit 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, or you get used to and you develop those routines and habits. And you go so far down a path that you get used to just teaching the course as opposed to reflecting on the skills and the knowledge required for the student to be successful and for their next step. Which is kind of what you're alluding to there. It's really important that, obviously, depending on what course we deliver and then how we deliver, that those points are actually at the forefront of our thinking, and that our curriculum, our teaching, our assessment is focused around skills and knowledge. And I guess colleagues listening may think, great, I kind of do that, or I don't know where to start. So what are your thoughts around that? How do we do that? So how do we reflect on our curriculum, Boyd, and kind of look at, well, and how do we focus that around skills and knowledge, would you say, from your experience?
I think a great believer in asking the student or asking the learner, you know, what do you want to learn? Yeah. You know, what are you going to get out of this lesson? And ask yourself, what I want to achieve in this lesson? Because I think sometimes over the years, you do kind of forget, you know, I mean, you teach the same PowerPoints, you teach, you know, you hand out the same handouts, you follow the same, to a certain extent I do, you know, you follow the same teaching plan. And I can imagine people that teach a purely academic subject,
yeah,
just wonder how much they change it every year, and how do they react to feedback. And I'm sure all colleges have their student reps and they have their sort of engagement with the students. And we certainly at Edinburgh College, we have every course has a student rep on the course, and they do get training by our EXA colleagues, and we should pay more heed to that, and we should pay more heed to the results that we got. You know, if we're only getting 60% retention, why is that? We really should be looking at that and to say, not blame the students. You know, and try and find out what we're doing or what we could do better to actually achieve better results, and listen to the voice of the student. I just said to students last week that you've got a bigger voice than I have in terms of shaping this course.
Yeah.
Because if and I've been doing it for years, if I go to my line manager and say, I need more equipment, the equipment's broken, I need to replace it, it's the same old mantra, we've got no money.
Yeah.
However, if the student goes and said, I can't do this course because I can't get a mixer because there's not enough mixers to go around, that has more sway.
Yeah.
So if students looked at it from that point of view in their learning as well, and we took on board something that they said, perhaps we would, you know, we would have a bit more success, or we would maybe, you know, our success would be a little higher than it is.
Well, that makes total sense because yeah, there's all these kind of micro factors as well that kind of contribute to student engagement, student satisfaction. And when I say micro factors, you know, there are so many components that we need to consider when developing, designing, and delivering the curriculum that if actually we could be the best teachers in the world if we don't have the right equipment, then unfortunately students can't then develop the skills and reflect the skills and so on and so forth there as well. And I think it's really important to kind of, and I'm keen to go back to what you're saying prior in terms of the knowledge and skills required for their employment or for industry or for apprenticeship. That absolutely needs to be at the forefront of our thinking when designing, developing and delivering the curriculum. And often, I'm not sure about kind of what your views are on this, but I feel like they often get overlooked sometimes in initial assessment or an induction, and not for the worst reasons in the world, because we often want to just get straight into the nitty-gritty of delivering the course. But actually, I think my belief is if we spend enough time understanding the skills and knowledge requirements and behaviours as well, using effective initial assessment and then developing the skills on the back of that, then it's a very clear starting point.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I mean, I think what I've tried to do over the last few years is I've had to try to get students to take more ownership of their learning as well.
Yep.
And one of the key things I do on my course is it's an SVQF level 7, so it's an HNC level course, which means it's got some units at level 8.
Yeah.
So in terms of verbs they need to use, you know, they need to understand, they need to develop, they need to explain. It's not just a case of show me a product and that's sufficient for competency. It's a lot more to that.
Yeah.
So one of the things that they have to do is they have to run the kitchen and develop a menu for our restaurant. We have a restaurant in the college that we use as our realistic working environment for our cookery students, and they have to develop quite a substantial portfolio around designing a menu and take hundreds of aspects into it. But one of the things they have to look at working with others, and so they have to take that into account. So they are thinking about respect, you know, things, you know, appreciate that not everybody's got the same ability as each other, and be respectful of that. Think about cultural differences, and look at an awful lot of unconscious biases that they have, and we all have. And so, you know, I spend quite a bit of time on the sort of different types of unconscious bias that might be in place, especially when you're being left in charge. You know, you basically, it's your kitchen, you've got 15 colleagues who are all on par with you, but you have to be the boss for a week, and you have to manage that whole sort of thing. So that's a good way of developing these kind of skills, because they're spread over the whole sort of like first semester learn them, and the second semester they put them into practice. So
yeah, and I think that's often important. Even again, sometimes these things are either assumed or just done naturally. It's important to highlight those as well, and that skills development over time as well with ourselves first and foremost, and then kind of with extras, sorry, with students, to help them understand their progress. So no, I think that's really interesting. And conscious of a bit of advice, because as a lecturer, it can be so complex, because there's always new things that there are so many things that we need to consider.
Yeah.
And I often refer to that as noise sometimes, which can detract from the basics of planning, delivering and assessing and developing our student skills. So I guess the final point for me really now, Boyd, is what advice would you give to yourself if you had to start teaching again? So we've got you taught 25 years, so you've seen so many things, you've delivered so many qualifications, let's not even go into that, but let's just draw back to, what advice would you give yourself if you were starting off again?
Well, I think if I briefly explain my sort of path to how I got into teaching and where I am now, in my previous my previous work life, I was in hospitality management side. So I did a degree in hospitality management, and I worked basically on the food and beverage side all my career. I eventually became a general manager. And I think after sort of 4 or 5 years of being a general manager, there was something wrong. You know, I just, my career just wasn't satisfying. I was in the wrong job, I think. And I'd spent all my sort of life training, and I was doing a lot of training. So I decided not to do that anymore. And I did a City and Guilds 7073, I think it was called, which was a practical way of teaching. And I did that at Edinburgh Telford College. And I learned how to, all the practical ways of teaching, none of the other methods, which I learned all about, the sort of motivational learning teaching when I did my TQFE, which was further down the line. But I think when I first started, I was very much, it was all about practical. And I didn't really engage with students that much, because I was just, all I was interested in was, this is your assessment, show me your competency, you're competent at that, move on to the next thing, move on to the next thing, and move on to the next thing. So I think I started part-time, and I think I learned from, I would not disrespectfully, but I learned from some old school teaching staff. So when I first started learning, I was learning from somebody who had 35 or 40 years experience. And they were very, very sort of set in their ways, and they didn't change anything. Everything was done the same sort of way. So I went along with that. I think that's what you do when you're new in your thing. And I was definitely learning all the time. And I think now what I would say to myself is, engage more with the student and their person. Be more empathetic with them. Find out more about them. Because the more you know about them, the better relationship you have with them. And when there are issues and things are not going well, you can sense it more. Because you're more engaged with the students. And I think the other thing is for me is allow them to take ownership of their learning. What I used to do is I used to come into the class and I used to pass out recipes and say, you're doing that, you're doing that, you're doing that. And then teach them or help them as they were going through it. What I do now is, and what I would say to myself now is, give them some credit. You know, one of the things I learned on this course I did recently was schemas. And, you know, people have got knowledge inside. They don't actually know they have it. And it's important that you get that information out and they can build on that. I think in TQF speak, we called it building blocks or scaffolding. But it's the same sort of thing. But recognise it and actually explain that to your learners, that, you know, you can actually build on what you already know. And you don't know you know it until I ask you a question and then you realise you do know it. So definitely, if I was doing things differently, it would be engage with the students in a different way, completely different way than I used to engage with them in the beginning of my career, where it was very, again, I recognise it now as an unconscious bias. Mm-hmm. I'm the boss. I know something, you don't know it, you need to learn it from me. And I think that's kind of the way you learn at school, but not the way you should be learning at college, you know. And I think it took me a long time to realise that that's the way I've been teaching.
No, I think that's really interesting, but it's a really kind of honest and interesting reflection. Yeah. And something I would kind of totally agree with, again, based on my own practice there as well. You know, I think it's difficult because as a new lecturer, you don't really know anything apart from your subject area. And you're trying to think of so many things. And as you then evolve the next kind of 2, 3, 4, 5 years, more things get added on top there as well. So you're absolutely right. And it's around kind of reflecting back to, well, why are we here? We're here for the learners and helping shape them and helping shape their career. And it's difficult because every student's different, every level is different, every qualification is different. But those overarching principles you just alluded to, I think are fundamental and are really interesting. And they'll kind of certainly help shape the practice and kind of help students on the right path with their learning journeys. So I think it's really interesting. And that's been a really interesting conversation, Boyd. And I guess to kind of bring it to a close, are there any other reflections either that you would like to share or like to think about? I know we've talked quite a bit there, and I'm going to say quite a short period of time. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think there's some really honest and interesting reflections. And yeah, I'm just keen about, is there anything else for you to kind of add on there? If not, it's absolutely fine. But anything else from yourself?
Yeah, there are a couple of things. I think the things, other things that I've changed over the years is I start my lessons with a mini lesson quite often.
Yeah.
So something that's not necessarily related to what the actual content of my lesson plan is. And that could just last 5 or 10 minutes. And it's kind of just to introduce a little bit of fun into the classroom and get a little bit of, maybe get their brains working a little bit. And they can be a little quiz, a little storytelling. Last week I asked my group to, I gave them 6 words and asked them to, in less than 50, make a story. And you include these 5 words in it. And it doesn't sound much on its own. And they were a bit dubious when they started. But by the time we finished, we had some hilarious little stories going. And again, it develops a relationship that, you know, I can laugh with them and have fun with them. I mean, I did it as well. It wasn't a case of you're going to do this. And I think that, you know, sometimes rather than just going straight into a lesson, it gets them a little bit woken up, a little bit engaged. And I do that fairly regularly. And I'm constantly checking for unconscious bias. I find myself sometimes saying something that, or plan on doing a thing, saying something, and then stop myself from actually, you know, actually doing it. And there are hundreds, I didn't realize, there are hundreds of ways you can, you know, apply a bias that you don't even realize you've done it until sort of afterwards. And what I've tried to do at the beginning is, one of the things I learned on this course I did recently was about neuroscience, and without going into too much in it, about how memory works. And it's really, really fascinating. And I think when I learned this, I thought to myself, oh my God, I've been teaching the wrong way for 20 years. Because basically, what do? We put up a PowerPoint and we talk to students for 15 minutes. We might have a little break in between and they do a little activity. And then what do at the end of it, we ask them to regurgitate everything they've learned.
Yeah.
Actually impossible. The brain can't possibly retain that kind of information at short-term memory. So I've kind of used that and tried to not to do that anymore. So I wouldn't say I've got rid of PowerPoints, but I rarely use PowerPoints. And I used to, and when you're online, that's quite hard because it's dead easy to put up PowerPoints and give them all this information and expect them to regurgitate it. So I think that's quite important as well, is look at creative ways that you can pass on information without using PowerPoints.
No, I think it's a really interesting nugget, and that just took me back to a moment about 10 years ago when I was still full-time lecturer, and we had a no pens, no PowerPoint week. You know, we challenged all the staff, and that was a bit extreme, but they could not deliver with a PowerPoint, and students couldn't use pens. Now, like I said, that was hard for a full-time week, but the principle of which is exactly what you're saying there, it encourages you as a practitioner to think, actually, well, what are you using a PowerPoint for? What do students write down? How can they learn? How can they learn in different ways there? And I guess it just goes to show, even kind of say our last 30-minute conversation, is all of the different considerations that we need to consider. Okay, it's the same word twice in a sense, but you know what I mean? As a lecturer, and all the different permutations out there. And that's why I think it's really important to draw back those principles you touched upon earlier around, well, we're trying to develop the knowledge and skills of our students. How we do that, there are so many different ways, but if those things are fundamental, you touched upon earlier on around the importance of assessment and feedback. There's a few core principles that are at the heart of our teaching, whether depending on, or irrespective rather, of the subject, the level, the medium by which we teach, that are really, really important to have at the core. And then those other aspects then just come around the side there. So no, I think that's really interesting. And boy, I'm afraid we've run out of time, but I think we could talk for another hour about so many other different things there. But I just want to thank you for your input there. I think it's really interesting, really insightful. And I think it also goes to show that, you know, when people reflect on lecturing and when people reflect on what makes good learning, like I say, it's a highly complicated space with a lot of noise. Well, actually, if we draw back to some of those principles that you've just touched upon there and how that shaped your career and your teaching experience, it shows actually where we should focus our time and attention. So thank you for your time, Boyd. Really appreciate it. And good luck for the rest of the academic session. Hopefully it's positive.
Okay, thank you very much. I've enjoyed our conversation, and hopefully we'll speak again in the future.
Fantastic. Thank you, Boyd.
Thank you. Bye-bye.